This is a Doxcast, not an Argon Soxcast, or a Bendis and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry. This is a Doxcast. It's a nerdy Toxcast. Discuss a Moxcast with Rich Early and friends.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another marvelous episode of the Doxcast. I am your co-host, Josh Trumbo, and with me, as always, is the true believer himself, Rich Early. Rich, how are you doing this evening?
I'm pretty good, and we're also with Darren Excelsior Gregson this evening. Oh,
thank you, Rich. Thank you. Hello.
Really, I think Excelsior sounds the best coming with your accent.
So everybody, we are just kicking off a night of podcasts, and we're going to kick it off with a bit of a Stan Lee tribute. There's nothing that anybody at this table is going to say about Stan Lee that's going to be smarter or different or more unique than someone else somewhere out there in the world, but we wanted to give customers a chance to join us with stories, memories, the first time you encountered Stan Lee, what's a Marvel character that he reached you through, you know, how did it affect your life, that sort of thing. I mean, Stan Lee really is just larger than life, Darren. I mean,
yes.
There aren't many cultural icons like him.
No, certainly not. I mean, you have to watch the Marvel movies to know that, because he turns up in every single one. So,
it's true. No, this is definitely a big thing. You know, I mean, this has affected a lot of people. Yeah, I mean, celebrity deaths tend to come with, you know, a fair amount of people expressing their sadness or regret and. On their passing and sharing good memories, but Stan Lee, I think, is someone that has managed to touch a lot of lives through the comics medium and then through movies and, you know, through so much that certainly we here at a comic book store should probably pay some sort of tribute to him and give others a chance to do so as well. So.
When I expect the industry, I expect Comics Pro or Marvel or Diamond to come up with a Stan Lee memorial event. You know, I think it just, you know, it takes time to do that stuff, obviously, but I think it's just a matter of time. You know, let's just talk the career for a second, and then what I thought we'd do to try to kick off memories is each of us are going to talk about either the first time that we knew who Stan Lee was or encountered him in some way, just to show all the different ways that he was out there. And I want to make sure that we talk about during the night, like, the message that he was delivering to us and what's important to continue on, you know, by us, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Stan Lee, you can look this up on Wikipedia, so I'm not going to go long into that, but, you know, he's born to Romanian immigrants in New York City. He was born in their apartment. it's kind of an interesting early story. But he was writing comics. His first fill-in comic was on Captain America in 1941. And he basically, he didn't create Captain America, but he did create the shield toss. The first comic that he wrote is the first time that the shield gets tossed and bounces back to Cap. So Stan Lee gets that as a tribute. But, I mean, that's not where most people know him. I mean, according to everything that I had read, you know, you get to the late 50s, and Timely Comics is now Atlas. And Atlas is, I mean, the comic industry is teetering on the edge. And Stan Lee was burned out and felt like he was done with comics. But Julius Schwartz over at DC, they come up with the Justice League. And the publisher of Marvel is like, whoa, Stan, hold on. You know, you gotta do something. This Justice League thing is, you know, lighten it up. What can we do in response to that? And Stan Lee's wife said to him, look, you want to quit anyway. Why don't you just do what you really want to do? You know, why don't you just do whatever you want to do and don't even worry about it. Just get it out there, you know? And so Stan Lee figured, well, okay, what the heck, you know? And that's where this era that changed everything came from, of flawed, human, relatable superheroes who they may have incredible power, but their aunt needs to get the rent paid, you know, or so on and so forth. And that's where it all comes from.
That's very cool. Yeah. And we've already got a comment here from Matthew Borcherding. Sorry if I butchered your name there, but said he was 6 years old when he got his first comic book, The Incredible Hulk 344. Todd McFarlane is the Auden.
Oh, the yeah, artist, yep. Mm-hmm.
And been hooked ever since then.
Nice.
And I yeah, that's very cool that, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about how comics can have a very deep impact on people. Certainly, Rich, you shared your story and how comic books were there for you during all those years going to hospitals and things of that nature. And Stan Lee, of course, is just a huge part of that because he was such a big part of comics and how they developed and, like you said, with the characters and making them flawed and real and relatable. And that's kind of been one of the big differences that people point out. And I'm not saying anything that's really revolutionary here, but, you know, between DC and Marvel, especially, DC is a bit more... bigger and boy, I just completely lost the words. They're more of like fables, you know, how there's help me out here, guys. I'm totally losing this. I hope you know where I'm going with this. Marvel has some of the more relatable stories.
Yeah.
It's more
yeah.
real world.
Yes.
Things take place in New York and places that we know. Whereas DC, there are these fictional cities that are,
yeah.
you know, you have Metropolis, which is like New York, but it's, you know, overstated in a way. It's, and so
you're perfectly explaining the difference. You're just tripping yourself up,
yeah,
right? So
like the specific words I'm trying to get out are not coming.
Superheroes in the 40s and superheroes in general in DC has this I can't think of the right word either, this like preconception that their heroes are perfect and larger than life. Mm-hmm. They really aren't, especially after the Silver Age, but Marvel set the tone for all of that. You go right down to Peter Parker just as the core Marvel character, you know, mm-hmm. and what he is. And I mean, my story would be finding Peter Parker, Spider-Man, when I was a little kid, and I've told it 1,000 times, but the only point to add to it is, you know, little kid having eye surgery, you know, finding this really colorful Spider-Man character to escape into. But if Spider-Man could deal with all the stuff that he had to on top of being a superhero, then it was okay that I could deal with my stuff, you know. And I think that's the big message that I've thought about Stan Lee the last couple of days is how he could reach you. He could connect with you through that character. He could build a relationship with you by helping you understand it was okay to be whoever you were, and you were going to be able to face the things you had to face in life. So, I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, my first, we were just talking about this, my first encounter with Stan Lee was the Spider-Man cartoon, in which he kind of narrated, I think, was it the beginning of the end and the end?
Yeah.
And, yep. His name must have been mentioned somewhere, even if it was in the credits, end credits, and I kind of locked onto that name. And eventually, when I started getting reprints of old Marvel comics, I would see Stan Lee Presents. I don't know whether I ever read anything that he'd written, but it just said Stan Lee Presents. And I was saying earlier that I just assumed he wrote everything at that point. You know, I'd still be 9 or 10 years old, and I just thought he created everything and he'd written everything. So, and that they are my earliest memories of Stan Lee. So.
Hey. I actually, you know, when you say that, I actually kind of think the same thing from when I was a little kid. Like,
yeah.
I remember Stan Lee Presents all over everything you know, just that made Stan Lee larger than life.
It did.
You know, if you picked up 1970s comics, well, even into the 80s, and it said Stan Lee Presents at the top, it's like, who's Stan Lee?
Yeah.
Like, he's a big deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, even into the 90s, I mean, I remember buying 90s books and it still said Stan Lee Presents, so... And he had Stan's soapbox in the back as well.
Yep.
Yeah, I used to read that. That was always entertaining to read what his thoughts were for that month. You know, whether it was like something, you know. I mean, and the subject matter varied, whether it was the state of the comic industry, his thoughts on the comic industry, and or other things that were more topical. Mm. It was, it, you know, he put it in there.
He was blogging before blogging.
That's
was
right.
Cool,
yes. Yes. So.
Comics would be clogging.
Yeah. Comic but blog. Can you imagine the creative burst that happened in the short period of time in the early 1960s to the first thing they create is Fantastic Four, he and Jack Kirby.
Yep.
But Kirby had done Challengers of the Unknown at DC, and so Fantastic Four really is a Marvel version of Challengers. But then it just, and the Fantastic Four is an instant hit.
Yeah.
And then it just goes bananas from there, including putting these characters together in the Avengers in one big book with all these different characters that they've created. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's something magical about, I don't know, maybe the first 5 years of what it was now considered the Silver Age, is that right?
Yep.
You know, you've got, I mean, just off the top of my head, there's Stan Lee writing, there's Steve Ditko drawing Spider-Man, and Jack Kirby doing several books a month with Stan Lee. I mean, all, you know, those creators as a unit were very, very, you know, coming up with some amazing work. And I mean, without going into too deep, I feel like they were never, on their own, they were never as good as they were together. That it was that magical period, maybe 5 years.
Something just went right,
yeah.
And that doesn't happen very often.
No.
That it goes that right. You can't plan that. You can't manufacture it. You can't. You know, you can want it to happen until the cows come home, but you can't make it happen. So.
Yeah. You know, the timing was right. There was just something in the air as well. You know, it's kind of, you know, you look back and it's like a phenomenon that you just can't explain. But, it was there, and it's why we're sitting here today, really, isn't it?
Stanley was one of those people who, and probably other creators with him, but he was one of those people who knew what people wanted when people probably didn't even know what they wanted. He was like he strikes me as the Barnum and Bailey circus creator. I mean, if you think about Spider-Man, right? There's an anthology series called Amazing Fantasy, and Spider-Man is just a character they created for the 15th issue, you know, who's one of the stories in the 15th issue of Amazing Fantasy. And you know what? Issue 15, I think, is the last issue of Amazing Fantasy on top of it. Huh. So, yeah. and he could have been, this happens a lot. I mean, this still happens today.
Yeah.
Recently in the last couple of years, there's been a story line the Spider-Verse stories that are now movies and video games too, but you know, they threw these characters at the wall, and you know, Spider-Gwen is the one that jumps out at me the most, that became like this big hit, and this, you know, so I mean, it still happens today where you gotta keep trying, you know, you gotta keep throwing stuff at the wall, and that's what they did, you know. And Spidey was I mean I, you know, I don't know if they knew or if it took fans reading it to tell them, hey, that's pretty good, you know, and the rest is history with Amazing Spider-Man. But to your point of that 5 year period, I find it very often when I go back and I'm not as knowledgeable on those books as I wish I was. Spider-Man, I kind of am a little bit. X-Men, a little bit, but I haven't read all the Fantastic Fours or the X-Men or the Avengers. Although I know things like in Fantastic Four, Galactus, you know, shows up in the first 50 issues.
Yeah,
the Skrulls are there right away.
Yeah.
Like, if you go back to that time, almost every comic you've picked up ever since then is some sort of retelling of a story from that first 5 years. That's not a hyperbole.
No.
That is honest to God. That is basically the exact truth of what happens in comics.
I didn't want to say that, but yeah.
You know, and rinse, repeat, you know, and sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad.
Yeah.
And
it's all built on that, all of it, you know.
It is. It's insane how built on all that is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's to have either such a solid foundation, which I think is definitely a big part of the case here. Like, there's so much in these characters and the stories that can either be retold to a new generation and have it make sense and have it be poignant and exciting, or be able to manipulate it a little bit and say, okay, well, remember the Skrulls? Let's put that into a story now, because people will really identify with what's happening in our world today, and we can put this in such a context, you know, and that's, I mean, that also goes for a lot of other forms of media, you know. How there are, people will say there's only X number of stories. You've got, you know, your coming of age story, and you've got whatever. And then those just kind of get recycled and recycled and told in slightly different ways. But, you know, if something is good,
yeah,
then well, it's going to
well, we're creatures of habit, too.
Yeah.
Because often you'll see in comics where someone will come along and they will try to do something new or yeah. something, and then no one wants it. Readership drops. And so even as readers, we want what's familiar.
Yeah.
You know, creators want that, and we want that as well. You know, so...
Yeah. I mean, I've read a little bit about Stanley, and one of the things that I do recall reading was... And this is obvious. He championed comics once he had that little bit of success, because I think he'd always aspired to be a fictional writer, like a prose writer, and that's why his real name wasn't Stan Lee; it was Stan Lieber, and he was saving his real name to when he could make it as a novelist. But Stan Lee obviously stuck, and he became successful. But you know, I believe he would go to colleges and he would talk about Marvel Comics and, you know, all these things, and he would promote them. And so, you know, he became a champion for that medium, even though it was still underground. And, you know, it's only really been sort of accepted today as an art form that's, you know, valid, really. But in those days, he was pushing. And that's one of the things I think Stan Lee is one of his greatest achievements was that he became a spokesperson for comics, really. And you, even if you didn't know much about comics, you might have an idea who Stan Lee is, you know. So, you know, I can't fault him for that. And that's, you know.
They often say, sorry, George, they often refer to Dan Didio, who runs DC, I think is like that. Like, I think Dan Didio is, but one of the things they say about him is, you know, he's a hot dog vendor. You know, meaning that, like, he's going to sell you hot dogs. Like, you know what I mean? So that's what you're saying about Stan Lee, right? Like he is just all in on his thing and totally believes in it, you know?
Yeah.
So, whereas you get, I mean, the impression you get, sadly, and I don't want to talk too much further, but the impression you get from Marvel today is a corporate. Shareholder atmosphere that isn't about they're not. I mean, you don't feel like they're looking to create the next Spider-Man. They're looking to get the pennies out of Spider-Man that they can.
You know?
I mean, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, so but it's a different atmosphere.
Yeah. No, and I was going to say real quick on Darren's point there, where you kind of have an idea of who Stan Lee is, even if you've never seen him. You know, I started really getting into comic books the first time in junior high, and I started picking up, like, I think X-Men. There was an X-Men comic that I grabbed at my local Walmart with my first starting to get into comics, like I said, for the first time there before I dropped off and came back and dropped off and came back. But I think my first real... actually knowing who Stan Lee was and understanding the impact he had was when I saw Mallrats.
Oh, yeah.
For the first time. And Stan Lee, of course, had a part in Mallrats.
Yeah.
And, you know, being a fan of Kevin Smith at the time, I knew his love of comic books, and for him to so lovingly craft a part for Stan Lee and put him in there kind of made a click in my mind. It's like, oh, yeah, this guy... must be, that's okay, that's that guy, he made Spider-Man, he's, you know, so that was kind of my first real realization of who Stan Lee actually was, not just a name, but the actual person. And of course, you know, he's done so much since then as well that he's really gotten cemented in the zeitgeist. Can I use that word?
Yes.
So not terribly pretentious.
That just reminds me, Josh, before I saw Mallrats many years earlier, there was a 90s thriller movie. I think it was called The Ambulance. It was a B movie for sure. And it had James Earl Jones in it and Eric Roberts, Julia Roberts' brother. And he was a comic artist in it. And Stan Lee was in it. He worked for Marvel Comics or whoever... You're supposed to think it's Marvel because Stan Lee, he's like his editor, and he's creating this character called Dr. Strong, and he's like looking over his shoulder while he's drawing it. And I think that was the first time I saw Stan Lee in anything. And I just, I had totally forgotten about that, but You just reminded me with the Morats, but it was called The Ambulance. It's a terrible film, but I'm sure Stan Lee is in it, playing Stan Lee. So there you go.
That's awesome. That might be worth looking up just to see that.
It's about an ambulance that picks up people, but it's not a real ambulance, and it takes them somewhere, and people start disappearing. So there you go. And it's got James Earl Jones in it.
Wow.
He's one of those. The reason I was thinking of him as a Barnum and Bailey, you know, is you try to entertain. You know, you just do whatever you can to entertain, and that's it. Just it felt like. You know, he was just flinging ideas at the walls, you know, and a lot of people do that, but his ideas were really good, was the, you know, so, although if you went back and looked, I wonder how many lost character, you know, let's go through the rest of Amazing Fantasy and see.
Yeah.
I was going to ask that, how many characters did he create that just went nowhere?
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see some of those. It'd be kind of cool for someone to dig through those and see if there's anything worth reviving there.
They probably have tried.
You know, all right, what's the next Spider-Man story? It's like, hey, let's find the amazing cockroach or whatever, you know, and bring that guy back.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
I can't remember who the publisher was at the time, but I think he was his uncle. I can't remember his name, but I think he wasn't happy about there being a spider as a character because people didn't like spiders. So he wasn't keen on Spider-Man. That I remember hearing about that, but obviously he was wrong about that. I just can't remember the publisher, the guy that was the publisher's name. I should look that up. So
that's really funny.
Yeah.
I never really thought about that because Spider-Man I never think of spiders.
No.
He shoots webs and stuff, but that's right. Like, very few people like spiders.
That's right.
His powers, does he climb into your mouth while you sleep?
Oh, no, don't say that. So.
One thing I wanted to bring up real quick here, and also before I say that, I do see we had a few more viewers joining us. Please feel free to share your Stan Lee stories with us. We've had a couple so far. If you can remember the first Marvel comic you bought or were gifted, or the first time maybe you became aware of Stan Lee or anything, feel free to share that because this is as much your opportunity to give tribute to the man as it is ours. So I also wanted to mention, I don't know if you can see it very well on the camera here, but I've got a pin. I don't know if you've heard about this, but Stan Lee's Hands of Respect.
Oh, okay.
My wife listens to Anna Faris's podcast, Unqualified, and he was a guest on there once, and they were talking about this this Hands of Respect thing that he started. And essentially all it is, I believe the story was that he and his daughter, JC, were watching some TV, and there were some political candidates on there, and they all had the little flag lapel pins. And she made a comment about, wouldn't it be nice, you know, in addition or to having just, you know, the Respect for America, you know, pin on there, that there was some kind of pin solidarity showing respect for peoples. And so Stan Lee then reportedly they discussed it. He thought that was a great idea. He designed this little pin, which is a couple of hands clasping with the word respect over it. And you can go, I believe it's just handsofrespect.com. You can go there and you can buy a pin for $10. And then if you buy one, you get an extra one to give to a friend. So you have two pins for $10. And it's just this neat little lapel pin. I usually keep it on my nerd bag with all my other pins. Just kind of a cool idea. And I think another way to really illustrate the goodness of Stan Lee, that, you know, all this is a chance to show that you respect people, and there's just a sign of solidarity there. It's just such a simple and small thing, but, you know, there you go. I'm spreading the word for you, Stan. Hopefully. Go check it out, handsofrespect.com. Like I said, it's $10 to get two pins, and you can just kind of wear them around and show a little bit of your love and support of humanity.
This is pretty much not on that track at all, so yeah. I apologize.
But no, that's right. I kind of went that way to make sure.
One thing that's interesting is it's not only the very first burst of characters either. You know, we knew him as the comic guy as we grew up, right? And now many people would know Stan Lee because he's associated with the Marvel Cinematic Universe or video games or whatever. But it's interesting to me how it continues to reach the message or the characters that he created continues to reach people, and not just the main big characters. I repeatedly have little kids come in and talk about Black Panther being their favorite character, or and things like that. And that's it's just astounding what the Marvel Universe, what it's become. You know, and you have to have the mega corporation behind it in order to have the money to do it, for sure. But that mega corporation has to have something to, I don't want to say exploit, you know, but something to use. You know what I don't have a great word, but you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And if you look at the ways and interpretations and recreations and expansions of just those first characters. And I mean, we're 60 years later, just about, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's just astounding.
Yeah. Well, and to your point there, Rich, you know, you have to have the corporate minds behind it to run things, but the fact that they've brought in so much good talent over the years that still kind of continues, you know, yeah, we're taking the old characters and finding ways to make them new or new stories to tell with them. But one thing I come back to is Jessica Jones, you know, and Brian Michael Bendis creating that and having a place where he could put that comic book out there, which, you know, whether you read the comic or watch the TV series, it's a very profound story that's being told there, in terms of, you know, the kind of the yes, all women movement and those sort of things that are really coming to the forefront now. And it's great that there's a place that fosters that kind of creative output. I mean, even going back, X-Men and just how X-Men is just a big analogy for human rights and how that ties in and how it's still so relevant.
And people talk about a couple of different versions of that they could be an allegory for homosexuals or an allegory for the minorities. Or there's so many interpretations of what the X-Men are. And then the idea that they're mutants. So by nature, it's like their name is something wrong with them. You know what I mean?
So
it's amazing. So.
Eric Broadshow just asked who our favorite B or C list Stan Lee creation would be. I'm not even sure where the different tiers.
No, me neither, actually.
Oh, I'm so. If you'd asked me which who was my favorite C list DC character, Eric, I'd have had a list about 20 long.
Mr. Gold.
Yeah. there are.
find a good list here to.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, you know, for me, my answer would be that there are a ton of Spider-Man villains that I think are just awesome. I think any corny Spider-Man villain, and I'm not, and I don't mean the main ones. You know, like the Vulture is a major one, I guess. Exactly.
That came to mind too.
Yeah, I don't mean like Dr. Octopus, you know, the ones everybody knows or whatever, right? So I love like Mysterio. I love Mysterio, and I think he's going to be the villain in the next thing. I don't even know why. He's just like he's got a fishbowl for a head. and
what are his powers even?
He tricks you. You know, he creates illusions
and
things like that, right? And he just looks really cool. But I mean,
right.
even that there's a good example of a very minor character. It could have been I'm sure it was created as a one-off villain, right? But look at the imagination by, I'm sure, Ditko to create that character design, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Do you have an answer for that?
No, I don't, because I don't know how a tier, you know, that they're tiered. And I just
sure.
I know who I know, you know, says the comic guy, you know, but I don't know.
Well, Hank Pym. I mean, Hank Pym. Maybe he's not A-list. I don't think. But like Hank Pym and Wasp, I think are really like I just like the simplicity of this guy gets really big and she gets really small. You know what I mean? Like like that. Just to make those into. And I remember thinking. You know, this is a great example, right? So one thing that Marvel has done so well recently is they've taken characters like that, you know, and they've made hundreds of millions of dollars on movies with them.
Yeah.
And at the same time, look at – it shouldn't turn into this, but, like, look at the flop of the Justice League movie, right? Versus how much money Ant-Man and the Wasp made, right? Yeah. Like, that's hilarious, you know.
I mean, that's –
go ahead and throw up Fin Fang Foom.
Oh, Fin Fang Foom's great.
Because I just love saying the name. I'm
Sure.
The list real quick, and that's maybe a lesser known in that way, but not among comic people.
He's probably a Stan Lee creation, but for some reason when I was a kid, I had a real thing for the Molecule Man, and I don't know why. Because if you take the Molecule Man to his logical conclusion, he's the single most powerful creation ever by anybody of anything, right? Like, he can manipulate every molecule. Oh, okay, so he can literally do anything. And like you know, oh, your lungs are now steel. Good luck, you know, or, you know, your heart is now made of cotton, you know, like, hope that works out for you. I mean, you know, there's nothing the guy couldn't do, you know, so.
Yeah. Matt mentioned there one of the best obscure villains is Paste Pot Pete.
What?
Yeah, I know, I've heard of him. I don't know. I admit I don't know anything about him, but yep.
I vaguely remember something about Paste Pot Pete.
No.
So, yeah. Eric Bradshaw, who's your favorite B or C list Stan Lee character? So, and have we heard back from Eric soon?
Not on that yet, but you enjoyed the answers we gave.
Oh, good.
But that's, you know, and actually that's okay. So seriously, that's fascinating. So one of the things that I criticize about Marvel and DC these days is it's a rights issue. It's if I was a good creator and I had a good idea, I would go do it on my own, right? and hope to get that movie deal. Ultimate example is like Ed Brubaker doing the Winter Soldier on the Captain America stuff. I mean, look at how integral that is to the multi-billion-dollar Marvel franchise, right? But the Winter Soldier idea didn't have to be Bucky Barnes. He could have. That idea is really cool that the Russians froze this guy and used him over the last 100 years to commit to do missions and stuff, right? What if he had gone to Image with that on his own, created it, and it was a billion-dollar movie that he, and maybe it wouldn't be a billion, but he might have made, you know, $100 million on it instead of zero, you know, or whatever minor percentage he probably got. So, but you no one, and I mean, if you go back to the 90s, we get Venom, we get Deadpool. I can't say we get Harley Quinn because she's from the cartoon, you know, from the animated series, but that doesn't happen. You know, like no one creates Venom and Deadpool now. Like, it does, you know, Cable, Bishop, all these characters. I mean, okay, Bishop's not, but Cable's a great example, right? Mm-hmm. All the X-Force characters, like that whole generation, that's all throwing characters at the wall. And who was it? It was Rob Liefeld. It was Todd McFarlane. It was, you know, it was all the guys who went off and created Image, right?
That's right.
And you're not gonna, so it's not always that it's their fault or whatever, but to think of the fact that if I was, you know, you and I are Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. We don't have a platform to design these characters based on, you know.
Yeah.
You know, 20 years from now, everybody's going to be just copying what we did for 50 issues. Mm-hmm. But every issue, we made up a new villain and a new story. And it all just came out of, you know, you pulled it out of thin air. I mean, it makes me think, too, the thing, like, that would say, like, if you want to write, the only way to write is just to write. Just to do it. And that's what this feels like. Like, Stan Lee was like, fine.
Yeah.
I'll just write crap.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
It might be crap. I don't know.
I'll
but
do whatever
I'm
doing I want.
It. Yep. So, you know. Yeah. So.
And Josh Herring threw out there that he would put Stan Lee up with some of the greatest authors, that his works have struck him as much, if not more, than books like The Hobbit and things like that.
Wow.
And I think that's really saying something because, you know, comic books, of course, are getting some traction now. But they're still not a very popular medium in the way that, you know, everyone knows all these comic book characters and stuff, and they go and see the movies, but they don't necessarily go down to the store and they buy the books. But there definitely is a greater respect for the medium, the art form itself. But I think you'd be hard to, there would be a lot of resistance from a group of people trying to make a statement like that. But I think that's very, very true. You know, that Stan Lee has had just as much influence as authors like Tolkien, and I mean, name it. It's so ingrained in our pop culture right now, and in our society, that Stan Lee has had he belongs up there on that list. And a lot of people, of course, you know, are sort of stuffy about that, and would be, well, no, it's comic books. They're, I mean, you look at how comic book movies still get snubbed at movie awards.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can. I mean, that's fine. I don't think you can really take that attitude at this point, given the monetary results we have from the box office and TV. You know, like that's, if that's your attitude you want to have, that's fine. And you can say it's not fine art, and get into all the arguments about commercial art versus pure art and all those sorts of things. But in terms of pure impact, I mean. Okay, I'm not comparing Stan Lee to Shakespeare, but you know, but Shakespeare wrote for the masses in the same way. You know, that was what he did, and he wrote a crap ton of plays.
Oh yeah,
you know, in the same way. So
just coughed them out, and there you go.
No, don't put on the title of this podcast. Rich compares Stan Lee to Shakespeare. You know, it's interesting though. You know what? 400 years ago, from now. What, you know, when people dissect this era in history and the culture of this time period, you know, what are they going to talk about? Are they going to talk about Stephen King and Stan Lee, or are they going to talk about Cormac McCarthy, you know, and so on? You know, it'll be interesting to see how that, what that is.
Yeah, I'm going to throw something out there.
Throw it away.
All right.
No prize. What was it? The Marvel No Prize.
Marvel No Prize.
Yeah. Was that Stanley's idea?
Probably.
I think if you spotted him, was it a mistake in one of the comics, and you told them about it, you received the no prize, which I think is literally no prize.
Right.
But I thought, you know, that's Stan Lee, you know. He's got some kooky, you know, cool ideas.
We actually stole that idea at CoreCon.
Okay.
We give out the Kamikaze Snowman Memorial No Prize Award for Excellence in Awesome Award, something like that. And that was something that was stolen directly from that idea of the No Prize there. So,
Eric Bradshaw says the Black Knight is one of his favorites.
I'm not familiar with the Black Knight, so it definitely.
Oh yeah, I mean, I read a lot of Avengers comics with the Black Knight. I mean, he was an Arthurian Black Knight riding around with the Avengers, you know. So the guys may know very much more about his actual history than me, but there you go. So
perfect.
There's a. I remember now. I don't know. Remember which issue? I think it's Amazing Spider-Man. There's an issue where they dealt with something like maybe drugs or something like that. And they couldn't get it past the comics code, so the actual issue was not approved by the comics code, and that was Stan Lee. He kind of he stuck his neck out and said, "Lo, we're going to publish this."
No, you're totally right. That's a true story, and he battled the comics code, and especially in the 70s.
Yeah. So there you go.
Stamp on there. Wasn't there something with Aunt May, like, or is that a different
story? I don't know.
She got like some villain hit her with something, I don't know, and it got her hooked on, I don't remember. There was something weird that happened with Aunt May. Probably completely unrelated.
I mean, well, that this is a sort of off Stan Lee musing, but it's, you know, like, there was a new Uncanny X-Men number one that came out today, and when you think about it, and I read it, and I always come at these things, and it's fine. It's a perfectly fine X-Men event book, you know, for X-Men readers, you know.
Yeah.
But I always come at them, and I want new, you know, not new, but I want new readers, you know.
Yeah. Like,
people have left this industry in droves. They just don't read comics, you know. And so when I pick these books up, I want to I don't know. I want a good starting point or a good, you know, I mean, you can't start over all the time, but somewhere to point to so that 3 years from now I can still be pointing to it and said, look, the Scott Snyder Batman run, right?
Yeah.
There's a perfect example. Yeah. Like, it wasn't a reinvention, a restart of Batman, but it was a run I could point to the beginning of and say, you know what, if you want to start, read the Court of Owls and then read the next thing. And then, you know, and that made so much sense to me, you know. But what it made me think of, too, though, is, you know, and part of the story is they're training another generation of new young mutants and they've been around for a little bit. But, you know, even I at this point, I'm like, I don't even really know who they are, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, if I was a kid, and this was my first X-Men comic, you know, oh, boy, it's, you know, it's $8. It's number one. You know, I've been seeing the hype about it. Mom went out and got it for me, and I'm really excited to sit down and read it, right? And it's impossible because I'm not a 10-year-old kid anymore, right? But I just can't imagine that there's as much joy to be had in the pages of that comic as there was in the pages of a comic in the 1960s from these guys, you know?
No,
and it's not like, look, not everybody, part of that's not fair. I'm not saying this creative team should live up to being Stan Lee and Steve Ditko or Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. That's totally unfair,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right?
I get that as well, but there is something to be said of, you can tell when there's love in it and when there's not, you know? You can tell, and so there's a twofold thing that's in my head about this. That's one. The other thing is the characters have been around for so long. There have been so many stories told about them that it's really hard for fans, for existing fans. If I, you know, I got into the X-Men around 1980, so I was early in the Claremont era, right towards the end of the Byrne Claremont run. But I mean, that's when I started. You know, that's my heart and soul. So my sense of ownership on the X-Men is that's what I always want. You know, when I pick up the X-Men, you know, mm-hmm. I want that kind of feeling,
sure.
And those kinds of stories.
Yeah.
But somebody else might have started in 1995,
yep.
And have been dealing with Adam X and X-Man and Cable and, you know, all the things that were going on in the 90s. And now that's their narrative. That's their
right.
ownership that they want. And the same thing, we could have had an X-Men fan start 3 years ago and meet the characters who are being trained in this issue that I don't know, you know. But there's so much history. How do you do something fresh with it? How do you break the story off and say this is a place to start over so on and so forth? But, I mean, Doctor Who does it. You know, Doctor Who just did it again, right, with another relaunch. So, I mean, so it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on this? Does it make any sense to anybody but me?
Yeah. Oh, no, I totally get you. And the thing is, I feel with Marvel Comics that really is past now for younger readers. If we're talking about, you know, those early experiences that, you know, Kirby and Lee kind of had and you, yourself in the later run. But, you know, you're going to have books now, like in 20 years' time, children are going to be maybe talking about Rainer Talgemeier's Smile and the Amulet books. You know, these are things that are going to be part of their reading experience, whereas we're, you know, the Marvel books were ours. So, you know, it's difficult to capture that. You can't force it either. So, you know, but I totally get you. You know, like, I'm sure there's people out there that think the Clone Saga in Spider-Man was the best thing ever, because
yes.
it might have been what they started reading.
Yeah.
And when they go back to it, which they do, I believe they do, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, the Clone Saga. But, you know, a lot of fans just do not like that stuff. But, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. Well, no, that's an interesting thing, and it's a tough spot that these companies find themselves in, because there's this constant talk, and, you know, and this has come up on the podcast before when going over a specific series or, you know, a relaunch or whatever, and the idea is that there needs to be something new. So, mm-hmm. you know, so they do a relaunch, whatever, but they have to appease the old fans. Like, they can't do too much different, because that's going to push away the old comic subscribers without necessarily bringing in new ones. And so it's this really tough position that they're in, you know, it's the rock and the hard place sort of thing, I guess, where if they just stopped writing Captain America books, people would get really mad. Like, they would just be super angry that Captain America no longer existed. But because Captain America has to stay on the shelf, and Iron Man, and X-Men, and, you know, name Spider-Man, every other comic book, because people expect them to stay on the shelves, there's very little room for them to put in anything new. And so people who want that joy of discovery, it's like, yeah, there's a relaunch, there's a new Hulk, there's a new so-and-so, whatever. It kind of works sometimes for some people, but I think if there was legitimately room for new characters on the shelves, and this is where a lot of the independent books come into play, then people might get more into the comics because, you know, people love to be in on the ground floor or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we just did that Keyforge pre-release event, and it's great to be in there on the, at the very start of something that feels like it's going to be big. And so I just get that feeling so much from seeing it because it's like, okay, well, here are the comic book characters that exist. We've got to keep them up there. And every so often you'll get, hey, so-and-so is making a new character. It's this book, and it's going to be a six-issue limited series, and then it's done. And then we're back to the same old characters, which they can still have interesting stories. There's still merit to having them out there. But yeah, I just get that feeling that holding on to that old guard and trying to appease all of the old fans while throwing just crumbs to the new ones and saying, why aren't we getting a lot more people into comic books? It's just...
I think Darren is making, and you are making the point that... Darren put this well, you know, the generation today wants something different. Whether that's good or bad, like our story was the Marvel comics in the 1960s, you know, maybe, or yours might have been, you know, the Transformers in the 1980s, whatever it was, right? And now it's this. But one thing that comics do, they need a new audience all the time, just like us comic shops. Hello. I think that there's a move to try to put what they think today's 13 to 18 year old wants into a comic book, right? Mm-hmm. But does today's 13 to 18 year old want a comic book? Even if you move even if you get the content right, even if you get the character right, are you trying to sell something to somebody who is never going to buy what you're trying to sell them?
Sure.
And in that case, in that situation, if that's true, then maybe you should let Marvel just be what Marvel is and accept the decline or accept that niche, you know, and then focus on the amulets and the smiles for the new generation rather than trying to shoehorn in new ideas into old places. So, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a bigger topic than we've got time for now because we're running up to the end, and I just want to make sure we mention that we've had some comments popping up here. Josh Herring said that his favorite Marvel story is the death of Gwen on the Revenge arc with Spider-Man, and Matt mentioned that the Immortal Hulk has been very good out of the new relaunches. Still maintains the roots of the character, but a good reinvention there.
Agreed completely. Matt, I kept meaning to get a hold of you and see if you're reading that, because I know you don't read a lot of new books, but I thought that one was something you should check out. So,
and I don't know if we have time to go on to this real quick, but Eric asked if we had any reflections on the unstoppable pairing of Lee and Kirby in that relationship.
We talked about that Groot early on, you know.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that already.
You know, so...
But he did mention that Groot was an obscure Lee Kirby collaboration there.
Yeah, he's from an Atlas. I thought his first appearance was from an Atlas comic in the late 50s. Is it from a horror comic? So, I didn't know Lee and Kirby actually did Groot. I just know that comic exists. So
interesting.
But I would only say, without going deep into that, I would only say that if you looked at the world today and you think about how hard it would be for something to be a cultural touchstone in the way that, I'll say, Star Wars was in 1976, right? Mm-hmm. You know, even Star Wars today comes and goes. Last Jedi was certainly a huge deal and got a lot of debate, but not... It doesn't resonate and last like other things do. And there are so many people creating so many things. I wonder how hard it would be. If Spider-Man didn't exist, right? It was created today. Is there room for that character to blow up? Is there room for that character to exist, given the fact there are an infinite number of YouTube channels of content, the dying, but still an infinite number of cable channels, and so on and so forth. You know, what would it be like today if the Marvel Universe didn't exist and now did? You know,
I think if Spider-Man came out today, he'd probably be a web comic.
Oh my goodness, that's so funny.
We're running out of time.
No, I was just going to say it would be like a cult thing, I think, Spider-Man, with it would just be have a few thousand readers, maybe. It would not be like it is. There's just too much.
It's from Dynamite Entertainment by Matt Kent and.
Yeah.
All
right. Well, we should probably go ahead and bring this one to a close. We have a few more podcasts we need to do tonight, and honestly, I think we could probably go on for quite a while about the creations of Stan Lee and his contributions to not only comic books but to our world as it exists. Any last thoughts we want to throw out there before we wrap it up?
No, I would say, I didn't have time. None of us had a lot of time to think about what this podcast would look like. I think the main, we said at the beginning, I am almost certain the industry will have a Stan Lee tribute event. It'll come along. Someone will organize it, whether it's Marvel, Diamond, Comics Pro, somebody else. Mm-hmm. So just give it a little time, and that's going to come together. And so let's wait and see. I even thought about us doing it, and then I thought, no, I'm just going to wait. I'm just going to lay back, the top-down version of that to appear. So
I did. I mean, this might be considered in poor taste. I don't know, but I do have a little display with some epic collections. I have Amazing Spider-Man Volume 1, Fantastic Four Volume 1, and Captain America Volume 1, and they're epic collections for $34.99, and they have the early work of Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and some of Stan Lee's Captain America work as well. So they're affordable if you want to dive in. You know, they're nice little books.
I don't think that's a bad idea. Maybe we could make a charitable donation or something.
Sure.
And that would solve that anyway. So.
Yeah. But.
I just want to say thanks, everybody, for listening, and stay tuned for more and more thoughtful tribute at some point, probably. This was good. I don't mean to disparage.
I mean, did we lose Steve Ditko this year as well? Was it this year?
I don't know if it was this year, but it was recent.
I've lost track. I'm losing track of time.
We're going to record two more podcasts tonight. If you're a DoxCast listener on audio, DoxCast appears every Monday morning, and it features all kinds of different things from around the shop, and it can be found on iTunes or on our website. And we try to record about once a month and do a block of episodes live like this. If you stick with us tonight, we are about to talk about our Black Friday buy two, get one free sale. And we have got wacky and zany combinations of things that you can buy from around the store as buy two, get one free.
Like, for example, you could buy all three of those epic collections.
That was on my list.
And then the night is going to close out after that. We're going to talk a little bit about the future. We've been making a lot of changes at Docs for a while, and we're going to make some really major ones. So if you're interested to kind of start getting a taste for what's happening now and what's going to be happening in 2019, stick around for that, or stay tuned in a couple of weeks on the podcast.
Yeah,
rightio. So yeah, thanks for tuning in. We really do appreciate everybody joining us in the chat tonight, sharing your stories, and it's really great to interact with you and pay a small tribute to the man himself. So thanks again. We hope that you'll stick around. We hope that you will join us on future podcasts. And until then, we will see you on the DoxCast.
This was a DoxCast. Hope you think it rocks cast. Oh, look at the clocks cast. Until next time, be gone.